Word. So appreciate that. But anyway, yeah, so you can print this out or you can follow along, but I'm going to have the Bible up. And for most of it, I'll also have the handout up for some of it where I have some extra information we might want. So now we'll say a prayer, just a short prayer, blessing on our study. Dear Heavenly Father, we thank you so much for the chance to be together digitally. And we just thank you that we live in the times we do with such great technology that even though there's this very serious plague around us, it has not been what it might have been decades or generations ago, that we've been relatively safe and healthy as a population, comparatively to what it certainly could have been. We do pray for all those who have lost people, but we thank you for being with us, and we thank you for this technology that enables us to be together and be able to distance from each other and yet still be together digitally. So thank you for that, and bless our study now as we turn to this important chapter. In Jesus' name, amen. So a quick review here. Let me share my screen. So four review questions, and these are not meant to take a long time, but we're going through, we're seeing the downfall of the nation of Israel. And right now we're focused on the northern kingdom, and we will be for a couple more weeks. Not the southern kingdom of Judah, but way up north in what we sometimes call Samaria. And even though they were always pretty wicked from the time they rebelled, their wickedness actually came in stages. And so I just want to make sure this is kind of firm in everybody's mind. So I got four review questions as we get up to Elisha now in today's chapter. First of all, what were the sins of Jeroboam, son of Nebat? He was the first king of the northern kingdom. He led the rebellion and started the civil war, and he introduced some bad things into their worship. Let's review briefly. What are those bad things?
Any guy could be a priest.
Mm-hmm. Priests were no longer Levites, but just anybody.
Changed the dates of worship.
Mm-hmm. A new worship. Services. New calendar.
High places.
Yeah, so worshiping at new worship sites and forbidding worship at the temple in Jerusalem. And those were the main things, all right? He continued to worship the Lord, Yahweh, as we might want to call him today to keep it clear, but he worshiped him in a totally different way. He wasn't really being faithful. Then number two, this review question, what were some major changes made by King Omri of Israel that improved the position of the northern kingdom, politically speaking? So King Omri was probably their greatest king of all time, or at least in the top two. And do you remember something he did?
Well, he bought the hill of Samaria, but how did that give them any advantage?
Well, the hill of Samaria, yeah, he moved their capital city to Samaria, which was an excellent defensive position. So that would come handy later when they're being invaded and attacked. So that was one thing.
He made alliances.
Yeah, and you can just leave it at that. He basically made alliances with all the other nations around him. And so now, instead of fighting all the time, they're at peace. But unfortunately, when he made alliances, his strongest alliance was with the city of Tyre, where Jezebel, his future daughter-in-law, lived. And then, so he had his son marry the princess of Tyre, and his son's name was Ahab, so now we're up to the guy we're looking at today. And question three, what did King Ahab change about their national worship? So here's the second major step down they're taking.
Serving Baal and making Asherah poles.
Yeah, and so I want to keep that clear. They changed their worship of Yahweh first, and then it was a generation or two later that they're now worshiping a completely other god. And this is where God starts to send prophets with much more serious and frequent signs of judgment. And so he sends Elisha. He gave Elisha the power to withhold the rain or send the rain, depending on what he felt was appropriate. And then where did he hide Elisha for 3 years at the beginning of his ministry? This is where we left off last time.
The ravine?
Yeah, he hid him first in a ravine where he was fed by wild ravens or crows. Kind of a disgusting thought, but he did that until there was no more water. And then He took him to a city and fed him in what miraculous way?
With the oil and the flour never running out.
Yeah, there was this widow and her son, and he goes and lives with this widow and son who live really close to the city of Sidon, where they worship Baal, the hometown of Jezebel. He's actually able to go there and live, and no one thinks to look for him because they think, why would the prophet of Yahweh be living so close to the homeland of Baal? So that gets us up to where we are today. So it's been 3 years now since he started his ministry, and now we get to 1 Kings chapter 18, verses 1 through 6. And, my screen share. No. I didn't mean to pause my screen share. There we go. And now could we get a volunteer? Sorry, I'm having trouble finding my buttons. There they are. Okay. A volunteer to read verses 1 through 6.
1 through 6?
Mm-hmm. 1 Kings 18.
After a long time, in the third year, the word of the Lord came to Elijah. Go and present yourself to Ahab, and I will send rain on the land. So Elijah went to present himself to Ahab. Now the famine was severe in Samaria, and Ahab had summoned Obadiah, his palace administrator. Obadiah was a devout believer in the Lord. While Jezebel was killing off the Lord's prophets, Obadiah had taken 100 prophets and hidden them in 2 caves, 50 in each, and had supplied them with food and water. Ahab said to Obadiah, go through the land to all the springs and valleys. Maybe we can find some grass to keep the horses and mules alive so that we will not have to kill any of our animals. Mm-hmm. So they divided the land they were to cover. Ahab was going in one direction and Obadiah in the other.
All right, muchas gracias there. And I've got two questions. So this kind of tells us, what were things like in Israel while Elisha was missing?
Pretty bad. Famine, no water.
Yeah, it's so bad that they have to scour the land looking for a tiny bit of grass. So very serious. And then question 6, the name Obadiah in Hebrew, it means servant of Yahweh. Yahweh is just sometimes the way we pronounce the Lord. It's God's personal name. This is what it sounds like in Hebrew, more or less. So anyway, servant of Yahweh, why is this a fitting name for him?
Because he didn't stray from serving the Lord, even though there was all the worship of Baal and the Asherah poles.
Yeah. So he's secretly, and it's interesting, he is, you know, working pretty high up in the palace, and he's working with Ahab presumably every day. He's trusted as an administrator, but secretly on the side, he's got 100 prophets, and he's feeding them with food and water, keeping them alive. And I'm sure that if Ahab knew about that, you know, off with his head, or at least he's going to be fired. He's wasting food on these prophets who have been banished. All right. Then I did have an interesting note from this NIV Zondervan Study Bible. Something I wouldn't have noticed, but it makes sense when you hear it. They say, as far as keeping the horses and mules alive, it portrays Ahab as a self-centered, callous ruler, scouring his kingdom for what little food and water remain in order to maintain his military strength rather than to ease the suffering of his subjects. And the annals of Assyria, the Assyrian ruler Shalmaneser III, report that Ahab could bring 2,000 chariots against him. So we do get this sense that he's really concerned more about his military and stuff than the actual people. Now here's a kind of a thought question. So we have to read verses 7 through 15. So another volunteer, and feel free to, you know, it's nice to have a variety of voices if anybody else would be willing to read. Call on people, but I feel like that would be crossing a line. So
I'll read.
Thank you. Thank you.
What?
I can do it.
7 to 15.
Mark, are you going to read?
No, you can.
All right, it'll be Jacob. Next one will be Mark. Next one will be Jim Nolmeyer.
If my children start screaming, Mark, you take over. As Obadiah was walking along, Elijah met him. Obadiah recognized him, bowed down to the ground, and said, "Is it really you, my lord Elijah?" "Yes," he replied. "Go tell your master Elijah is here." "What have I done wrong?" asked Obadiah, "that you are handing your servant over to Ahab to be put to death? As surely as the Lord your God lives, there is not a nation or kingdom where my master has not sent someone to look for you. And whenever a nation or kingdom claimed you were there, he made them swear they could not find you. But now you tell me to go to my master and say, 'Elijah is here.' I don't know where the spirit of the Lord may carry you when I leave you. If I go and tell Ahab and he doesn't find you, he will kill me. Yet I, your servant, have worshipped the Lord since my youth. Haven't you heard, my Lord, what I did while Jezebel was killing the prophets of the Lord? I hid 100 of the Lord's prophets in 2 caves, 50 in each, and supplied them with food and water. And now you tell me to go to my master and say, 'Elijah is here. He will kill me.' Elijah said, 'As the Lord Almighty lives, whom I serve, I will surely present myself to Ahab today.'"
All right. Thank you very much. Yaakov, which is your name in Hebrew. So, question 7. This is sort of a thought question, and I just like these to help us put ourselves in the minds of the people. In what way was Obadiah's fear justified? And be prepared to answer both. But first, in what way was Obadiah's fear justified?
His wife was killing off prophets.
Okay, yeah. And so it's very light. I mean, it's very logical. That would be his fate, right? He's going to be killed if he goes and says, "Oh, by the way, I saw Elijah and, you know, we're friends, and he's here." Okay. Any other reasons his fear would be justified in a certain sense?
Well, he was afraid that Elijah wasn't going to show up and present himself to Ahab.
Mm-hmm.
And so he went back and reported that he saw Elijah, and Elijah didn't show up, then the king would take revenge on Obadiah for not killing him.
Yeah, especially when Obadiah has this habit on the side of hiding prophets, and it's not, you know, maybe that would come out or something if he started investigating. So, yeah, you can understand his fear, at least to some degree. But then the other side of the question, in what ways was his fear not justified?
Well, he's already been at risk of being killed. He's a prophet.
Mm-hmm.
And he's protecting other prophets. And that puts him at more risk of being killed. So, and he's been trusting God his entire life, or at least mm-hmm. since the youth. Mm-hmm. So why stop now?
Yeah. Yeah, so that's the other side of it. So even though you can always find reasons, you know, ultimately there's no need to be so afraid. Now, let's see. The next question is kind of an application for us. When we are afraid of something, we tend to think, "I know I'm a Christian and I'm not supposed to be afraid." But now correct that kind of thinking.
Since I am a Christian, I should not be afraid. God is with me and will never leave me.
Yeah. And those other things, they might be valid concerns, but they don't, they're not stronger concerns than the fact God is with you, right? Whatever it is, whatever the thing is we're afraid of. And actually the sermon today talks a lot about that. So I'll leave it there. At least the one I put together, it's on Psalm 91. But in order to keep moving, I think everybody kind of understands here. He eventually persuades him to go tell him, and so he does. Now we get to the exciting part. So let's look at verses 16 through 18, and we're going to kind of go through this slowly, and I have a question or two every maybe two or three verses, just to kind of let it sink in. So anybody willing to read 16 to 18? Wait, no, we said it would be Mark Gaulke next. If you're still free, if your kids are not.
Yeah.
Okay, good.
So Obadiah went to meet Ahab and told him, And Ahab went to meet Elijah. When he saw Elijah, he said to him, "Is that you, you troubler of Israel?" "I have not made trouble for Israel," Elijah replied, "but you and your father's family have. You have abandoned the Lord's commands and have followed the Baals."
Okay, yeah, and I wanted to stop there. We could keep going, but I think this is worth dwelling on. What does Ahab think about Elijah?
Troublemaker.
Yeah, he's a troublemaker. And so let's flesh this out. How has, in his mind, how has Elijah made trouble? What is Elijah's great sin?
He's withheld the rain.
Yeah. Okay. Withheld the rain.
He's pointed out his the bad things that Ahab or the rest of them have done.
Yeah. And so he's bringing, I guess you could say, disharmony. He's bringing trouble by exposing the wrong of changing and worshiping Baal and then withholding the rain. Now, the thing is, you'd think if a guy has the power to withhold the rain, it's kind of silly to blame him. Obviously, this is coming from a higher power, and they know who he is. He's a prophet of Yahweh. So it doesn't completely hold up. But I think it's worth noting that his enemies really, and Ahab really believes Elisha's the problem. If we can just get rid of Elijah, sometimes they call him Elisha, by the way, sorry, but Elijah, if he could just get rid of him, then everything would be fine. And question number 10, many of us, I think we want to make other people happy. We want good relationships. We want to have a good reputation. What lesson can this teach those of us with such tendencies? And if there's some young people, especially, you know, as you're heading into life, I think this can be a good lesson for you. Oops, why? Why did it say?
Are you asking why is such a people pleaser?
Following the Lord is not always the popular thing to be doing.
Yeah. And so, what can you expect?
Criticism, persecution.
Yeah. People will not like you, and they might even blame you for problems. You know, if you say something to a family member or a friend or a coworker, and whether it's about believing in Jesus, whether it's about some moral issue that the Bible's clear on, they might hate you and they might really believe you are the problem. And that hurts, you know, when someone you care about or someone who's kind of has their opinion about you matters. And they think you're the problem? You don't want to be the problem, right? And so we should understand that's going to happen. But the thing is, when we're speaking the truth, we're never the troublers. You know, people might think we are, but the trouble is when people don't believe the Lord. And that's what Elisha said in 18. They abandoned the Lord's command and followed the Baals. And all they're trying to do is bring them back. And so Elisha is not the one. So I thought that was worth dwelling on. And for younger people in particular, I know you kind of have to learn this lesson a few times before it really sinks in. Because the first couple times, maybe you think, oh, if I just did something differently, if I just worded it differently, or if I showed I really cared about them, you know, maybe then they won't be so upset with me for my moral and religious stance. But eventually you learn, sometimes there's nothing you can do. They're just not going to like you. And then you got to decide, am I following Jesus? Do I care about pleasing him or do I care about pleasing them? So a worthwhile lesson. But now we can keep moving. Or were there any other comments on that?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
You did a fine job. I was thinking it does get pretty basic where you can explain it from the kid's perspective, perhaps, of something, people stealing stuff and you not wanting to steal it, or being around some guys who are drinking beer when you're not supposed to be drinking beer and you don't want to partake in it, or you're the might end up actually telling on them and that's how they look at it. You caused the trouble. You told on us.
Yeah.
Or you messed it up that we got caught.
Yeah.
Or from at work where either people are stealing stuff that the company owns or you're just stealing time from your company.
Yeah.
Oh, and they think you're the guy messing it up.
Yeah, very good examples. Yeah, especially if everybody's stealing from the company, you know, if everybody's reporting more overtime or, you know, that happens a lot where there's some trick to clocking in or, you know. Yeah, good. Anything else?
Yeah, Pastor, I just wanted to say, I guess, two comments that I see this also with just when any problems really pop up in people's lives at times where they try and explain it away by saying, well, if I do more of this, if I spend more time on that my problems will go away. And really, a lot of times it's just your relationship with the Lord that's in error and you're not putting him first, and that affects other things. So there's the blame game side of that. And I think there's also just your personal meditation on God as well. And I guess my comment to what you said is that just really hit home, because I know, like, I feel like you and I kind of dealt with that issue last year with, there were some school parents like that, and that you teach law and gospel, and I'm sure you've had this so many times in your ministry, that you teach law and gospel and they just don't want to hear it, and you can try and work with them or whatever, but the real issue is they just don't want to hear God's word, and they're going to blame you as a result.
Yeah. Yep, exactly. So don't think that people's reaction to you reflects anything wrong with you necessarily. I mean, we always want to examine ourselves, but it could be just that you're being faithful. So, good. Anything else? Let's keep moving just to make sure we cover a decent amount of ground here, but good comments all. Now, verses 19 through 20. Was it Mark Gaulke last time? Okay.
Yep.
Would you mind taking these two as well? And then we'll go to Jim Nolmeyer after this.
People from all over Israel to meet me on Mount Carmel, and bring the 450 prophets of Baal and the 400 prophets of Asherah who eat at Jezebel's table. So Ahab sent word throughout all Israel and assembled the prophets on Mount Carmel.
Thank you. Maybe I'll just point out the key things here to notice. So it's going to be people from all over Israel. This is a big showdown right now. They're meeting at Mount Carmel, and I can show you a map of where this is. Oops, I will unlink these so it doesn't keep changing my place. Mount Carmel is on the coast. It's kind of on the northern coast. It's pretty close to where, wrong one, that's why. Wait, what? Ah, sorry, it just closed the one I wanted you to look at. It's very near to where, why is it? Okay, this always happens. There we go. We're going to look at the ESV Study Bible that has the good maps. And it's right up here. Yeah, you can see Mount Carmel is sort of right here. I guess, was it really worth all that? I don't know. But it's the only natural harbor that they have in Israel. And you can kind of tell on this map, but there is a ridge line that stretches like this. And it kind of divides Israel in north and south. And it's a very prominent site. If you go there to Israel today and they take you on a tour, it's kind of steep. And so you have a very good view of everything. And there is a bit of a natural amphitheater in one little spot. So this would be a very good location to bring together people from all over Israel. And that's really the thing I'm trying to highlight, that, you know, it's not just a few people there. This is a major national event, and 450 prophets of Baal and 400 additional, I believe, prophets of Asherah. So the total would be, let me make 850. Yes, a lot of people, and that's correct. Math on the fly is always hard. People who eat at Jezebel's table, that seems to indicate maybe a lot of these, we know this, but it's quite possible that most of these prophets of Baal and prophets of Asherah are actually not from Israel originally. I would assume some of them are, but perhaps many of them are from Tyre and other areas where they have been brought in order to support the new Baal religion. So it is possible that a certain amount of this whole conflict is sort of foreign religion versus native religion, but it's not clear that that's the case. Certainly many of the native people had just swallowed Baal worship hook, line, and sinker. So that's the setting, and now we're going to get the ground rules. Although first, verse 21, I'll just read it because it's only one verse. Elijah went before the people and said, "How long will you waver between two opinions? If the Lord is God, follow him. But if Baal is God, follow him." But the people said nothing. So what kind of a picture does that paint to you of the people at this time? What adjectives might you use to describe them?
Maybe apathy.
Apathy, yeah. They have fear. It could also be fear because they know what happens if you speak up for... Yep.
Wishy-washy.
Yeah. Now, can you empathize with them at all? Not that it's good to be this way, but can you understand why they might be this way? Thinking of their life in the Northern Kingdom at this time.
The king and the queen were powerful and wicked, and I don't want to die.
Yeah, so that's part of it. Anything else that could lead them to be somewhat apathetic? Even before Ahab.
No one was there to teach them the right way.
Yeah, they may have never really known much about Yahweh and the truth, right? Because their worship, you know, they had been living with so much false teaching for such a long time. Many of them had probably never gone to Jerusalem. They probably never heard the Torah read. And who knows if they really knew much at all. I mean, we can't imagine the ignorance most of them probably had about the Lord in an age when people were illiterate and they didn't even have anyone reading the Bible to them. Who knows what they thought about the Lord? Maybe there were more prophets than we're aware of, but maybe not. So, we can empathize a little bit, and that's why God does send Elijah now to correct this. So I'll hand it over to Jim now, because this is a longer section, verses 22 to 25. These are the rules for the contest. Oh, sorry, you're muted. Let me unmute. You got to unmute yourself there.
Oh, excuse me.
Yep, that's all right.
Then Elijah said to them, "I am the only one of the Lord's prophets left, but Baal has 450 prophets. Get two bulls for us. Let Baal's prophets choose one for themselves and let them cut it into pieces and put it on the wood, but not set fire to it. I will prepare the other bull and put it on the wood, but not set fire to it. Then you call on the name of your God, and I will call on the name of the Lord. The God who answers by fire, he is God." Then all the people said, "What you say is good." Elijah said to the prophets of Baal, "Choose one of the bulls and prepare it first, since there are so many of you. Call on the name of your God, but do not light the fire." So okay. They took the bull, given them, and prepared it.
Good, thank you. Yeah, and we'll stop there for this part. So those are the ground rules for the contest. First of all, how would this contest demonstrate who was the true God?
Well, if the bowl was lit on fire, then it would be from their God.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's and pretty risky not, move to take. I didn't catch the last thing you said. I was speaking.
Oh, if it did not happen, then.
Oh, yep, exactly.
It would not.
Then the God hasn't answered. Now, the thing is, I mean, it's not like you can normally just do this and expect God to answer, but Elisha was a prophet, and so he had, I guess, this power and this confidence. I mean, I wouldn't do this today, certainly, and expect that God would answer it this way, but back then it worked. And so it's pretty clear, fire falls from heaven, that is the true God. Evidently, this is the sign they needed at this time. Then part B of question 13, can you think of anything in Israel's history that this would remind them of?
Was it when Moses put the had all the snakes and or threw down his staff with the snakes? I can't remember exactly the.
Yeah, and you know, actually, I didn't have something in mind in particular. That does jump out to me is probably the closest parallel that I can think of is that incident, because at the beginning of Moses's ministry, he was in a little competition with the. I don't know if the priests, the magicians of Egypt, and they could sort of do the same thing he did. But then there came a point when they couldn't replicate his miracles. So I think it could have reminded them of that. Did it remind anyone else of anything else in Bible history?
Abraham and Isaac, but not one.
Actually, that was the main one I thought of as well, but there could be others. And remember, in the Transfiguration, it's Moses and Elijah who were there talking to Jesus. And I think it's because these are both guys who really did amazing things, obviously through the power of the Lord and his instruction. But other, you know, no one else really matches these kind of miracles in terms of their drama and their power and the impact that they have on people who are watching. I can't think of anybody, maybe Joshua, but he's sort of seen as Moses' successor, Elisha, but he's seen as Elijah's successor. So nothing else jumps out at me as really being on par with these level of miracles. So it's not like miracles happened all the time in the Old Testament either. All right, so it would have been pretty clear who was the true God, presuming one of them answered. And then now we get to the really fun part, the prophets of Baal and their attempt to get Baal to listen. And I believe this is supposed to be, I don't know if it's comical, but it's at least kind of mocking pagan religion. So, and we already had Jim read, so a new person to read verses 26 through 29.
Esther, I have a question.
Oh yeah, please.
How can people consider themselves prophets of Baal if they, like, mm-hmm. Baal doesn't speak to them or any, like.
Oh, well, yeah, he did. So this is a bigger issue, but actually in the, not just, we don't really know from the Bible the details, but we know from ancient Mesopotamia, in ancient Egypt, in ancient Greece, and pretty much all ancient societies that prophets were in fact very common all over the ancient world. So all sorts of different religions had prophets. And in fact, what I personally believe is that probably some of them did have some sort of relationship with demonic entities. I don't believe it was all just in their heads. But in any case, it was very normal for them to try to predict the future, especially. But normally what they would do, getting dreams and visions from their local god was somewhat, I mean, it wasn't the most common way they would predict the future. They had things like, oh, not necromancy, what's it called? Hepatology, something like that, heptoscopy. They had this thing where they would actually kill animals and then make a sacrifice to the god, and then they would examine either their liver or their entrails, and they would look for signs to predict the future. Or sometimes they had other weird things that they would do trying to communicate with the gods. Of course, they had people who tried to communicate with the dead as well. It was, we know that in different cultures, sometimes people would go and sleep in the temple of a god, and they believed that the dreams they got while they were sleeping in the temple would be a message from the god they were worshiping. So there were prophets in other cultures, and we actually have them. This map doesn't go quite far enough north, but if you go, I don't know, another 200 or 300 miles north and you hit the Euphrates River up here, there's a city called Mari, and we actually have a list of prophecies that existed. The king went around to all the little villages and stuff in his kingdom, and he said, go talk to all the little prophets in the villages and stuff and ask them for predictions. He wrote it down, and they have it in the archives. It was baked clay, and it survived. So that's just a brief answer. I mean, there's a ton more you could read, and I could review my knowledge too, but there were prophets all over the ancient world. So, and of course, if you think that they're just kind of all making it up, I don't totally understand how that would work. They could have just been self-deluded, but I mean, I believe there's demonic stuff involved. And I think the same thing about Buddhism and a lot of different religions around the world today as well.
So do people just name themselves prophets, or does someone else do it for you? Like,
yeah, I think you just kind of feel the call. You're maybe interested in that kind of thing. I don't think it's totally known how they would become a prophet. To be fair, though, we don't really know how most of the Israelites became prophets either. I mean, Elisha was anointed to be Elijah's successor, but we don't know how he first became a prophet. And there's lots of prophets. So it is a little bit shrouded in mystery. I think for the great prophets who spoke on God's behalf, like Elijah, God certainly selected them. And we see that they get calls. But then there's other prophets who maybe all they did was just repeat what Elijah said. And I don't know if they had to be called or not by God. Because remember, there's hundreds of prophets at this time. We only hear about kind of the leading couple prophets. So it's kind of there's a lot we don't know.
Well, there's not just that, but there's also false prophets. So anybody can name themselves a prophet. So you don't know. A true prophet had to be someone who was really called by God.
Yeah, yeah. Or they had to be the test that Moses gives them in Deuteronomy, that what they say must always come true. And also they must be teaching according to the Torah at all times. Good point. So we do get that even in the Bible. False prophets everywhere. I better stop rambling, though, on that. And just, so any other thoughts? Did we actually read this section yet? No.
Nope.
We had a question first. So yeah, given all that, we've got these prophets now, and let's have somebody read what they're doing. This, I think, tells us a little bit about their religion. There's actually a lot in here that fits with what we know about Baal worship. So if anybody could read it.
May I?
Yes, please.
You're gonna have to move that little thing.
Oh.
There you go. So they took the bowl given them and prepared it. Then they called on the name of Baal from morning till noon. Baal, answer us, they shouted. But there was no response. No one answered. And they danced around the altar they made. And soon Elijah began to taunt them. Shout louder, he said. Surely he is a god. Perhaps he is deep in thought, or busy, or traveling. Maybe he is sleeping and must be awakened. So they shouted louder and slashed themselves with swords and spears, as was their custom, until their blood flowed. Midday passed, and they continued their frantic prophesying until the time for evening sacrifice. But there was no response. No one answered. No one paid attention.
Okay, thank you. And I just have a few notes. This is from the NIV's Zondervan Study Bible. And there's some things in here that actually relate to what we know about Baal worship. So dancing around the altar, first of all, that was pretty common in pagan religions. Just most other religions believe you had to kind of get God's attention, you know, and you, in fact, the ancient Greek dramas and the plays, famous people like Euripides and Aeschines, that developed from this idea that those plays were performances dedicated to the gods and were seen as religious things. So that was a normal thing that they used to do. When it says here, perhaps he is deep in thought, busy, or traveling, perhaps he is sleeping. When it says busy, they say perhaps that's a euphemism for relieving himself. I think other translations had that. When it says maybe he's traveling, this may allude to Baal's regular descent to the underworld in ritual death. So they did believe that every year during winter, Baal went to the underworld, and that's why you had winter, and it wasn't a fertile season. And then he came back, and then, because he was the god of grain and harvest and everything, and rain, and then when he came back, that's when, you know, things started to come alive again. And possibly sleeping and must be awakened, that could be a reference to what they believed about him. And then, you know, they're slashing themselves with spears. It's a very bloody thing, but obviously no one's listening. Anything? Oh, yeah. So a question for you. Do you think that Elijah's taunting was cruel?
No.
It's funny. I think it's kind of funny.
It's funny.
Okay. Yeah. I don't know. Does anybody
have a sense of humor?
Yeah, he seems to. Yeah, kind of satire. Was his taunting necessary?
Maybe.
No. Yes.
He was trying to make a point, I think.
Yeah. I mean, is he a bully rubbing it in? Or is this perhaps something that needs to be done? And remember, this isn't just for the sake of taunting the prophets of Baal. Who is assembled before him watching this?
All the other people who couldn't decide.
Yeah. So he is helping them get off the fence. He's helping them realize the futility of Baal worship and really trying to get them now to turn to the Lord. So then I have this agree, disagree, question C, but if you, you know, I'll just read it. It's not enough, agree or disagree. It's not enough to proclaim the true God. We also have to show the futility of people's idols. Agree or disagree?
Well, God chose the of people's idols. He goes on and on about how they have eyes but can't see, and they have ears but cannot hear, and they have mouths but they can't speak, and okay. They are less.
Yeah. Oh, good point. So we got many other passages of the Bible that talk it the same way. Other thoughts?
But you don't have to rub it in somebody's nose that the thing that they're worshiping—it's not good evangelism to rub it in somebody's face. You can go about evangelizing a whole nother way.
All right. On the one hand, it's not good evangelism to rub it in somebody's face that they're wrong. On the other hand, if you come telling somebody about Jesus and how He saves us, and they say, "Well, I've already got everything I need. Why should I be interested in that?"
Are they going to law and gospel? You still need to know you need it.
Yeah, I think that's kind of law and gospel. Good point. That really law is you have other gods who do not save you. You know, you worship things other than the true God. But I think pointing out sometimes the futility of the things we trust in is an effective preaching of the law. So like now, when a lot of the things we have always taken for granted are taken away from us, it's not bad to point out to people, you know, is it really good to base your life on the assumption that, you know, your wealth and your just ability to do normal things and your health will always be there?
Pastor, I think
go ahead.
It seems to me to kind of like discount the power of God's word that if you also feel like, shouldn't you just be able to tell them God's word, and then from there, it's the Holy Spirit's job. It's not our job to go around taunting people and telling them, like, what you're doing is not, like, is, I don't know, to make, like, belittle people.
I guess I'd agree. We don't want to belittle people. That's why I made it an agree-disagree question. I think there's kind of different angles you can take.
Pastor, we had a number of years ago, we had a one or two school families, at least one school family,
mm-hmm.
that belonged to another Christian church, but they wanted to join our church as well and belong to both churches.
Yeah.
And so we obviously wouldn't let them join our church. And there wasn't a difference between having a false God and a true God, but even Christians, it's important for us to tell them why and what our belief is and what the Bible says, and why that they couldn't belong to two different churches.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not just non-believers, but also believers.
Yeah,
that you can witness to.
Actually, that reminds me of the some stories from our missionaries in Africa and India. That in India, especially, it's evangelism is the easiest thing you've ever seen. Pretty much any Hindu you talk to and you tell them about Jesus, they will say, oh yeah, I believe in him. I'm going to worship him from now on. And they'll maybe ask you for a little cross or a little symbol or something, and they will take it home and they'll put it on their mantle with, you know, their 30 other gods that they worship. Mm-hmm. So it's very easy to get people to worship Jesus. But he said what's about, not about impossible, but takes a lot more work and is a lot less common, is for them to say, I'm going to put aside those other altars and I'm going to worship him. In Africa, it's not worshiping other gods, but it's amulets and black magic type things, you know, lucky charms that they really do believe in. It's not just a, I don't know, it's not like a lucky rabbit's foot here that doesn't really mean anything. It's kind of like voodoo type things that they will turn to when they're sick or they need help or something. So, I don't know, pointing out, this is what Elisha does, right? I mean, he could have just said, everybody assemble, and I'm going to give you a speech, and I'm going to read you from the Torah, and you're going to be convicted. But apparently, this is, you know, this is obviously the way God led him to have this confrontation. So, there's other times, though, when that's not what it takes. But I think we can at least say sometimes people need to see the futility of their idols before they're really, their eyes are open to, or their ears are open to seeing and hearing God's goodness.
You need, I mean, yeah. I guess my question with this is, I mean, how does taunting, or why does taunting have to be the necessity to show futility?
I don't think we'd say you'd ever have to taunt. No, I mean, that's just how we did it here. But in his case, I mean, this is, he's a prophet and he's inspired. So for him, it was the right move. But I mean, I'm not trying to say we should go around taunting people.
Well, in his case, so they actually set up a competition.
Yeah.
So it was in a different context than what we may encounter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no. Go
ahead. Witnessing to a friend is a different, just as different circumstances than here, where they had set up this contest and the whole nation was assembled, and to have some visual of who's the real God.
Yeah. Right. So, I mean, it's very different. The only point of comparison I would draw is sometimes it's good to expose the futility of idols. And the Bible doesn't just do that here, like Anna pointed out right away. There's many Psalms that do that. And, you know, Jesus does that, I think, indirectly as well. You know, you cannot serve both God and money. And he tells lots of parables, tells the parable about the rich fool. And basically the whole point is there, that guy had made riches his idol. And look what happened at the end. So there is a place for that in our witnessing, and when we do it, we're not relying on ourselves, we're just following the Bible's example. Just to make sure we get a little further, I want to keep moving if that's okay, but this is a good, good discussion. Well, let's see, do we have time to finish though? Now we're at 7 minutes. We've got 15 verses, and that's 2 verses a minute. Anybody got something else to say on this topic?
All yeah, right, is well, it possible? Is yes. it possible that Elijah, he didn't want to leave any doubt. He didn't want them to come back and be like, well, we didn't try our hardest to get Baal to do this.
Could be, yeah. So maybe he's egging them on in that way. Yeah, that would make sense. Well, we won't finish the section, but we can at least read the next little paragraph as I've broken it down. So let's just do 30 to 35, and we'll have to stop there. And next week, we'll pick it up at this point, and that's okay. So anybody 30 to 35?
I will.
Thank you.
And Elijah said to all the people, "Come here to me." They came to him, and he repaired the altar of the Lord, which had been torn down. Elijah took 12 stones, one for each of the tribes descended from Jacob, to whom the word of the Lord had come, saying, "Your name shall be Israel." With the stones, he built an altar in the name of the Lord, and he dug a trench around it, large enough to hold 2 seas of seed. He arranged the wood, cut the bull into pieces, and laid it on the wood. Then he said to them, "Fill 4 large jars with water and pour it on the offering and on the wood. Do it again," he said, and they did it again. "Do it a 3rd time," he ordered, and they did it a 3rd time. The water ran down around the altar and even filled the trench.
Okay, and just the last question to examine here. How is his sacrifice so different from the prophets of Baal?
He trusted that God was going to answer and bring down fire even on a dripping wet bowl.
Yeah. Good. And so there's sort of 2 aspects. He trusted, and the fact that he covers it with water. I mean, that's obviously the big difference we can all notice. They don't drench theirs. Now, really, did drenching it with water somehow decrease the likelihood of fire coming down from heaven? I mean, not really. You know, if fire is going to come down from heaven, it can be as hot as God wants it to, right? So again, like Jim was saying, this is kind of for visual effect. It's equally miraculous, I think, when God answers, but it just is really driving home, because remember, there's thousands of people assembled and watching and letting them take this in, that hey, this God not only answers, but he answers in this kind of over the top remarkable way. Do you notice anything else? Do you see any significance maybe in the things they did that he does not do?
Well, he's not slashing himself and making himself bleed, and he's not dancing around like a maniac.
Yeah. In fact, maybe I should have had us look at verses 36 and 37. I'll just read that real quick. At the time of the sacrifice, the prophet Elijah stepped forward and prayed, "Lord, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, let it be known today that you are God in Israel and that I am your servant and have done all these things at your command. Answer me, Lord. Answer me. So these people will know you, Lord, or that you, Lord, are God, and that you are turning their hearts back again." So there's actually a lot of things there. Why do you think this happens at the time of sacrifice? Does anybody catch the reference there?
I'm not sure about the time of sacrifice thing, but I did notice that he called the people to himself and they helped him. Mm-hmm. And then he calls on the Lord. So he is in that, he's in that mediary role kind of between God and the people.
Yeah, he is. And he's sort of speaking to God. He's directing his thoughts to God, but then also he's communicating to the people what God is doing. God is turning their hearts back again. A great example of revival. Revival is not our work. A revival is God working in the hearts of people. And the, you know, like times like the Reformation, they really happen when God moved people to care about him again. And he's clear that's what's happening. The time of sacrifice, this is referring to how in the temple in Jerusalem every day, in the morning and in the evening, they would have a sacrifice of a lamb. Every single day, I mean, no matter what, this was on top of all the other sacrifices. And so he's, even though they're not in Jerusalem, these people have not followed the Jerusalem laws for a long time, he's still faithful to the Torah and to the true God who gave the Torah. So I think that's why he's doing it at that time. Although I think other people also had an evening sacrifice, so it's not unique to Yahweh and the temple. And so, yeah, he has a very simple, direct prayer. God, do this. Keep your promises. I'm your servant. And God answers. He doesn't have to slash himself. He doesn't have to shout or dance or do anything to get his attention. He already has God's attention. So it's a very different version of the Lord. All right, so then next time we'll have to see the after effect. Probably everybody knows what happens. I don't think this is going to be a cliffhanger, that the Lord answers from heaven and the fire comes down and consumes his sacrifice. So, of course, God is now proven, and maybe we'll just look at 39. All the people saw this. They fell prostrate, a word that we probably only use when we're reading the Bible and talking about falling prostrate, by the way. They fell and they cried, "The Lord, he is God. The Lord, he is God." And so now this great revival happens. It's short-lived, but it does seem like the worship of Baal is done away with for a while. And the people sort of turn against Ahab and Jezebel to some degree. All right, so we'll pick that.